Welcome to episode 224 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, June 24th, 2012. I'm the Solomonster. It is a beautifully sunny day here in New York. Hopefully it is nice wherever you may be. Right off the bat, if you haven't read the interview with Ken Doan on SEScoops.com, the former Kenny Dykstra of Spirit Squad fame in WWE, you can check it out on the front page right now. It is a fascinating and probably very honest read about being part of the Spirit Squad and Dolph Ziggler's future in WWE, John Cena, of course, allegedly cheating on his then-fiancé with Doan's then-girlfriend, Mickey James, and how it led to the end of his run in WWE. Just really interesting stuff. He does come across as a tad bit angry, I would say, but as was pointed out to me, you would be too if your girlfriend was cheating on you and through no fault of your own, you then lost your dream job and had your reputation sullied. I read the stuff about Cena sleeping around, and I don't know whether the specific tales that he tells are true, but it certainly sounds credible to me. You know, Cena's got a dirty side to him. I remember that from the Howard Stern show many years ago when he was on once, and let's just say that the PG version of John Cena we see on television is very different than the John Cena in that interview, openly talking about banging fat chicks and not being able to turn down women and whatever else he was talking about. WWE's done a pretty good job of getting the audio yanked from YouTube, but yeah, the dude has fun, and there's nothing wrong with having fun, but I can see where if it was your girlfriend or my girlfriend doing the nasty with John Cena, you may not be too happy about that. Anyway, you can check out the interview on the front page. Congrats to Webmaster Mike with the scoop. Or is it SE scoop? Maybe it's an SE scoop that he got. I guess you can say it either way. The interview got picked up all over the place and was one of the big stories this week, so check it out. Also, today marks the 5-year anniversary of the death of Chris Benoit, who committed suicide after killing his wife Nancy and his son Daniel. His body was found the next day, only a couple of hours before a scheduled 3-hour Raw show, which was turned into a 3-hour tribute to his life and career. 24 hours later, it became very apparent what had really happened, and his name has never been spoken of again on WWE television. In fact, they have done everything in their power to erase him from history. And he was one of the greatest workers of all time, for sure, but none of that matters now because, well, when you murder your family, that's not something you can just excuse. He had physically abused Nancy in the past, so there were clearly anger issues there with Chris that went back many years. And it all came to a head 5 years ago this weekend for reasons that we will likely never know. It is easily the most horrendous tragedy, I think, ever associated with professional wrestling. Owen Hart is another one that comes to mind, but that was an unfortunate accident, and one man lost his life. In this case, three people lost their lives. And it is still hard for me to reconcile that this even happened, but it did 5 years ago this weekend. On a lighter note, this week marks the 10-year anniversary of John Cena's WWE debut on SmackDown against Kurt Angle. The date was June 27th, to be exact. He and Angle actually had a hell of a little match on that show. Cena busted out some moves that I have not seen him use since. I just watched the match earlier when it came to my attention. I watched it on YouTube. This was during the Ruthless Aggression era, and Kurt Angle is looking for anybody in the back, any young guy in the back that he's never challenged before to come on down and face the Olympic gold medalist. And out came John Cena wearing actual wrestling tights and wrestling boots. This was quite the scene here. He comes out and tells Kurt Angle that he's here for some Ruthless Aggression. And he went right after Angle. Like I said, they had a pretty good match. And, of course, Kurt won. Won with something of a roll-up type move, actually. So didn't even beat John Cena with his finisher or make him look bad. This was a classic example of a wily veteran putting over a new guy, putting over a younger guy. John Cena came out of this match looking strong, looking like he had the potential to be somebody. And I wish we would see more matches like this today instead of seeing people get squashed on television every week and seeing, you know, Dolph Ziggler eat a brogue kick 4 times in a row and, you know, lose every single week to Sheamus and stuff like that. But this was pretty good stuff. And again, 10 years later, here we are. You see how valuable to the company John Cena has become. It is amazing to think of how close he came to being cut a couple of months after his debut here before Stephanie McMahon saw him dress up as the rapper. Poor man's Vanilla Ice on that one SmackDown episode on Halloween. And the rest, as they say, is history. So 10 years ago this week, John Cena arrived in WWE, and he's been here ever since. And I know some people will rue the day and curse the day that he ever did make his debut, but let's be honest, where would WWE be today without John Cena? Think about that. Think about how scary a proposition that would be. Because we'd still be in the PG era, but there would be somebody else coming out and smiling and doing all these annoying things, but who knows if they would be nearly as over as Cena is. It's actually quite scary to think where the company would be without him. So let's get into it here. We had a pay-per-view last weekend, WWE No Way Out from East Rutherford, New Jersey, not too far from where I am here. Wasn't a bad show. Had some good wrestling on it, but this notion that because I went on Twitter and said that the show was boring. At one point during the show, I tweeted that the show was boring, because it was. And somehow, there are a few people that took this to mean that I am a hypocrite, because all I ever do is talk about wanting to see more wrestling, and, you know, here, that's what they gave us. Yes, you fools, but there's two points that you are neglecting. First, you can have all the wrestling you want on a show. That doesn't mean it's all good wrestling. Some of it was good, but a lot of it was not. Second, when have I ever complained about the lack of wrestling on these pay-per-view shows? Of course you're going to get more in-ring action on a pay-per-view show. That's to be expected. You know that going in. They always give us more wrestling on pay-per-view than they do on Raw or SmackDown. Well, most of the time. Extreme Rules was a wrestling-heavy show, and was probably the best show of the year from an in-ring standpoint. I really enjoyed that show, just like I really enjoyed TNA Slammiversary show 2 weeks ago. I didn't really enjoy No Way Out all that much. Didn't feel like anything special. Didn't help that the crowd was lifeless for many of the matches. I can't really blame them. Sorry if I expect these pay-per-view shows to be held to a different standard than your typical average edition of SmackDown. What a horrible person I am. Anyway, I was correct on all but one of my predictions, so I am on a roll now with these things. I'm like Ryback, only much smaller and with hair. The only one I got wrong was the Divas match. I figured Beth would win the championship. She did not. I realized afterwards that I don't think I ever gave a prediction for the Tuxedo match as though it really mattered. I would have gone with Santino anyway, but really, who cares? So just to run through the matches really quickly here. We had the pre-show match, of course, David Otunga and Brodus Clay. I missed this match, but I did not hear a single good thing about it. Otunga got himself counted out. The way this finish reads on paper sounds absolutely atrocious. So apparently this match got the pay-per-view festivities off to a rip-roaring start. Sheamus and Dolph Ziggler actually started the pay-per-view. World Heavyweight Championship on the line. They had a really good match, you know. A few uncharacteristically dicey moments here. Not necessarily as crisp as some of the matches they've had before, but otherwise it was pretty good stuff. Of course, Ziggler ate a bro kick for the pin, but I didn't really expect him to win the title. I mean, hell, he wasn't even supposed to be in this match originally. He was more like a plan C, I think. And I was going to talk about how the company should now stop curtain-jerking this guy and get him a little higher up on the card, but then I saw that he had yet another match with Sheamus on SmackDown this week, and I believe that's their fourth TV match in the last month. And once again, Dolph Ziggler ate a bro kick and lost, the second time in a week. Just funny to me, because if they ever do turn him babyface, Ziggler that is, or they start pushing him as something special, he won't move ratings or anything. You know, people won't even care. And they'll wonder why the guy can't get over. Maybe having him lose over and over and over again on TV has something to do with that. I don't know, just a thought. Just a thought that I had. Or maybe they're jobbing him out more now because he's Ken Doan's friend, and they want to take it out on him for some wacky political reasons. I don't know. I mean, it's as good a theory I have as any other one I could think of. I just don't understand the logic behind having Ziggler lose like this every single week, but what the hell do I know? Santino Marella, Ricardo Rodriguez had a tuxedo match. I don't really need to recap this. Santino won. Ricardo was shown wearing underwear, bearing the likeness of Alberto Del Rio. I think this was supposed to be funny. It was not. Christian and Cody Rhodes had an Intercontinental Championship match. Like the opener, very good match. Christian wins with the spear and a nice little homage to his buddy Edge. Apparently, Christian had a great match with Alberto Del Rio on SmackDown this week. I have not seen it yet. Christian just has great matches. I mean, this guy is just very good at what he does. I mean, go back to last year when he was a heel, having all those great matches. Even just before he turned heel, he had a couple of great matches with Randy Orton. Probably the feud of the year in 2011. And now Christian, of course, back from his... actually, he had a couple of different injuries, mainly the ankle injury. But the guy is just a great pro wrestler. He's fun to watch in the ring, and he had a great match here with Cody. We had the Usos against Epico and Primo, against Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel, against Titus O'Neil and Darren Young. A four-way number one contenders tag team match added to the show at the last minute. It was a chance to showcase some tag team talent who I am sure they will just forget about in 3 weeks. Or maybe, just maybe, when Raw moves to 3 hours, we'll start to see some of these guys like the primetime players and Tyson Kidd be featured in matches that actually mean something. I won't hold my breath on that because I'll probably die. But I can have hope. Young and O'Neil, they call themselves the primetime players, as I mentioned. They won the match. They aligned with Abraham Washington afterwards, who then turned on Primo and Epico. So after being together for only a few weeks, they've already split up. And I like the primetime players. If for no other reason, because it's nice to have an actual tag team with a team name, they get my vote for that reason alone. I want to see more of that in WWE. I'm tired of having, you know, people with just their last names put together as a makeshift tag team. I want more teams with cool names. I want Demolition. I want the Road Warriors. I want the Brain Busters. I want the Heart Foundation. Primetime Players. New Age Outlaws. That's fine. I like it. I want to see more of it. We had a Triple H promo. He came out without his mechanical brace, looking pretty good for a guy that had his arm broken less than 2 months ago that we were told he would need surgery for. Well, in his defense, Triple H has always had incredible recuperative powers, so this should come as no surprise. Remember when Steve Austin dropped him from 50 feet in the air, in a car, onto pavement, and he was back next week with what they called only minor contusions? He's unbreakable, this guy. Michael Elgin stole Triple H's gimmick, as far as I'm concerned. Triple H claimed that his arm is getting better each day. I'll bet it is. He talked about the two lawsuits pending against him and the company from Paul Heyman. He said that he wanted to fight Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, only he did it in his trademark Triple H voice. He said, "Brock, let's fight." You know, I can't do it quite as well as he does, but that was pretty much the gist of the whole thing. Came out to challenge Lesnar. Not one of his stronger promos, I would say, but he got his point across to Triple H. So let the countdown begin. T-minus 2 months until Triple H beats Brock. Layla and Beth Phoenix had a match for the Divas Championship. Layla pinned Beth to retain the title. Not a very good match. It just felt really off. And the crowd was totally dead for this. They just could not care less. You would think it was an empty arena match or something. Just not good. Sin Cara and Hunico was added. Yet another one added at the last minute. I would complain about this being their 87th match together on TV, but they work well together. And after watching that YouTube show with Hunico that I talked about last week at home with all of his lucha masks and everything, I like the guy. And I wish they would do more with him instead of just feeding him to Sin Cara all the time. The problem here also is that Sin Cara is very good at doing the dazzling moves and flying around the ring and all of that. And here they gave us a bunch of rest holds. You know, they grounded Sin Cara way too much in this match. When that happens, all that you're left with is a guy that can't cut promos because he doesn't speak English and has no facial expressions because he wears a mask. So what are you really left with if not for all the spectacular moves? You know, that's the problem. Let Sin Cara do what he does best. They talk about how, oh, Sin Cara is the most famous or the most popular wrestler in the history of Mexico, which is a crock of shit, of course. I don't know why they keep saying that. That's just completely ridiculous. But you know what? The reason he got over so big in Mexico and was so popular for many years and was the top drawing card down there was because of how cool, quite frankly, it was to watch him in the ring. He would fly all over the place and do things that a lot of people had never seen done before. And when you take that away from him, because I don't know why you take that away from him. Maybe because you want him to work the, quote, safe WWE style. Maybe they don't want him to get over the way he got over in Mexico. They're trying to teach him a lesson because he's got attitude problems. I don't know. I don't know what goes through their minds. But this was, compared to other Sin Cara Hunico matches I've seen, a rather, I don't want to say boring, but a rather uneventful, tame match that did not really accentuate Sin Cara's strengths, as I think that they should have. Unless he still is having issues with his knee, and it's just him being overly cautious. So I haven't heard that his knee is giving him any trouble. I think he's fully recovered from his surgery, but who knows. But this was not the best match I've seen them have. He did win with the La Mystica over Junico, and so that was that. CM Punk, Kane, and Daniel Bryan, triple threat match for the WWE Championship. Punk retains, as I predicted. Of course, AJ played into the finish. He ran down to the ring, got knocked off the apron. I was going to say knocked up. That was actually pretty funny. Got knocked off the apron, taking a bump to the floor. Punk gave Kane the GTS, which is pretty impressive. Not an easy thing to get a guy that big up there. And got the pin. And Kane later carried AJ to the back. He was her knight in shining, I guess shining red armor, you would say. She had this look on her face that indicated she really wasn't hurt. She smiled at Punk and I think winked at him. And this was actually a pretty good match by Triple Threat standards, better than I expected it to be. It would have been so much better as a singles match with Punk and Bryan. I stand by what I said before. I did not like this match going in. And just because it turned out to be a really good match doesn't mean that we, you know, I'm not upset that we didn't get a better match. I still think Punk versus Bryan, whether it's in a cage or you know, two out of three falls or whatever stip they wanted to add, I think it would have been much better. And Punk and Bryan were over more than anybody else on the entire show by far. Bryan in particular. Now, not surprising, they're in New Jersey. You know, they're in the Northeast. Bryan, of course, wrestled a lot for Ring of Honor up and down the East Coast. Punk did as well. They're going to probably be more popular in New Jersey, let's say, than they would be in Louisville, Kentucky, or, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, or something. But these are the two most popular guys in the entire show, and I think if you would have just put them in there one-on-one, this could have been maybe even more of a classic than their match at Over the Limit. I don't know. But this was still very good. I'm not complaining. Dan Delaney and Rob Grimes were the two jobbers that they fed to Ryback on this show. Yet another unannounced match thrown in there at the last second. Ryback won. He then shouted, "Feed me three." Followed that up by saying, "Feed me more, feed me four." Portion control is important. That's why this country is so obese. So this is a horrible lesson for the kids whenever Ryback comes out and says, "Feed me more." Just wanted to point that out. Main event was John Cena and The Big Show in a steel cage match where if John Cena lost, he would be fired. Try not to laugh when I say that. And if Big Show lost, John Laurinaitis would be fired. This was not up to snuff as far as WWE pay-per-view main events go. It was every cage match you've probably ever seen, your average cage match, nothing spectacular about it at all. Cena won, as I predicted, because no way were they dumb enough to do another firing angle with him that nobody would believe. Why they even added it in the first place, I have no idea. It basically gave away the finish of this match, as far as I'm concerned. The story here is that all of the superstars that have been beaten up and bullied in some form or fashion by Big Show, I think everybody except R-Truth, came out to prevent him from escaping the cage after he nailed Cena with a knockout punch. So Brodus Clay came out and blocked his way from exiting through the door. Alex Riley ran down. He got knocked off the cage. Zack Ryder ran down, got knocked out with one punch. Kofi Kingston ran down. Kofi was the only one who had any real luck here, knocking the Big Show off the side of the cage, back down into the ring. And that gave Cena enough time to recover and climb out. Vince McMahon fired John Laurinaitis, and John Cena gave him an FU through the announce table. People cheered. They liked it. It was okay, I thought. It would appear, based on Big Show being in Money in the Bank next month, and John Cena, as of right now, not even having an opponent for the next pay-per-view, that this feud is over after one match. And I'm fine with that, if that's the case. I mean, normally you would start with a singles match and then build to something like a cage match. In this case, they went right to the steel cage match. So really, where else do you go from here with Cena and Big Show? I like my suggestion, which I made on Twitter right after the show ended a week ago on Sunday. I said that with Punk retaining and Cena winning his match, it would make sense to match the two of them up, I think, at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view next month, exactly 1 year after that classic match they had at last year's show. You know, let WWE make up its mind once and for all on who it is that they want to be the top guy in the company, and let that championship headline these pay-per-views from now on instead of relegating it to the undercard. If that means putting the title on John Cena, as much as I don't like that idea, so be it. And if you want Punk to be that guy, and I think he should be, quite frankly, I think Punk ought to hold the title for a year until at least Survivor Series, then keep the title on Punk and let him headline some pay-per-views instead of putting... I mean, really, on this show is another example of CM Punk was in a match that was, in my opinion, far better than John Cena's match. Now, obviously, Cena had that match with Laurinaitis last month. We knew that match would suck, and it did. And Punk went out there with Daniel Bryan, and that match should have been the main event. I'm sorry. On this show, Punk's match was also very good. So I don't see the reason why you wouldn't put CM Punk's matches at the end of the show. It just doesn't make sense to me. If you want to make the argument that, okay, CM Punk, for whatever reason on television, does not equal ratings and John Cena does, fine. Then put Punk's segment wherever you want to put it on the show and let John Cena headline the show. Even if I still don't like that, fine, I understand it. The order of the matches on the pay-per-view is irrelevant. You know, people are going to buy the pay-per-view or they're not going to buy the pay-per-view. You already have their money. Once the show starts, the WWE champion should be headlining the show, especially if he's going out there and consistently having the best match on the show. Just doesn't make any sense to me. So I would suggest putting the two of them together at Money in the Bank. Let them have this great babyface versus babyface championship main event match, and may the best man win. I don't think that's the direction they're going in. I would love to see another Punk vs. Bryan match if they could revisit that. It would seem to me that they don't want to go back in that direction. I think that may be over with. I don't know. I guess with the AJ storyline, it's probably not. But we'll see what they do. We'll find out, I guess, on Raw whether or not Cena's going to have any match at Money in the Bank, because right now he does not. Before I move on to Raw and Impact here, talk about those TV shows and a lot of shit that went down, I want to give some thoughts on the new NXT show. The new NXT from Full Sail University debuted this week. It is airing, I know, internationally in some countries, on television in Canada and places like that. Unfortunately, in the U.S., I think it's only airing locally in whatever market it is down in the Florida area. I think it's Tampa, on the Bright House Network or whatever it is. Originally, they were not going to air the show on WWE.com. Then they changed their minds, and then what do you know? They changed their minds yet again, and they decided we're not gonna show this on WWE.com, which to me is completely foolish on their part, because if for whatever reason they want to protect these guys and they don't want us to see them before they're ready to be on television, I don't understand the logic behind it, only because NXT popped up all over YouTube this week. And I know WWE went and they got it yanked down, but it's still popping up on YouTube. It's up on Daily Motion. You cannot keep these shows from us. You cannot keep these shows from the internet. People will find a way. They will find a way to watch this show. Why wouldn't you just say, you know what, people are going to find this show anyway. Let's promote it on our website, and let's get some traffic for our website. They're going to see it anyway. Let's reap the benefits of this. But instead, they want to hold it. They want to protect it. They want to somehow shield it from our eyes. And it doesn't matter. I still saw the show. I found ways to see it. A lot of people did. And I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was a very good show. Lots of good things I think about it to like going forward, not the least of which is Jim Ross and William Regal on commentary. I think they work very well together. Now, unfortunately, I believe that they will only be the announcers for the full show for the first, I think, 3 or 4 episodes, if I'm not mistaken. William Regal will, going forward, be an announcer on the show. I don't know who his broadcast partner will be, if it will be the announcer from FCW, but Jim Ross has indicated that he will not be broadcasting these full shows after, I believe, episode 4. I could be wrong about that. He will, however, call the main events. So he just won't call the entire thing. But you know what? A little bit of Jim Ross is better than no Jim Ross. But listening to him on this show call the whole thing with Regal, I knew that these guys were going to be the announcers. I had heard that they were going to be the announcers, and I knew they would be good. But until you actually watch the show and listen to them and how they're giving you all the little details about these guys and how they came up and the places they've wrestled before and all of these different little nuggets of information, trying to get them over, it really hits you. Why the fuck are Jim Ross and William Regal calling NXT and not on Raw? Why are they not on Raw? Why are they not on SmackDown? Why are they not on pay-per-view? At a time when almost nobody is getting over, your announcers can really do a lot in helping get some of these people over, making them feel special, making them feel important, instead of mocking them and burying them and fake laughing at them on commentary. It's so goddamn annoying to me. I don't understand the thought process that goes into it. I just don't. It frustrates me. It really frustrates me, because I'm going to watch Raw every week. You know, I'm a fan. I review the show for my show. I feel like I have to watch Raw every week. I know I'm literally not forced to, but I feel compelled. I have to watch Raw every week, no matter how bad it may be. And it would be so much more tolerable for me if I just had people who actually knew what the hell they were doing and were trying to make the show more enjoyable on commentary instead of people who just don't give a shit. So, anyway, that was my thought on the whole announcers. They make the show so good. And on this particular show, a couple of other things. First of all, Tyson Kidd and Michael McGillicuddy had a great main event. This is not a match that would even make Raw. You know, maybe it would be a main event on Superstars. And even then, it would probably be a mid-card match on Superstars. But on this show, it was the main event. They gave these guys, I think, close to 20 minutes. They went out there, and they had a hell of a wrestling match. They showed that these guys know how to work. They know how to wrestle. They're probably very much underrated and underutilized in WWE. Go figure. But they had a great match. They really did. And what they also used the show to do was, first of all, the show started. I love the Full Sail arena they have there. It reminds me a lot of the Impact Zone. Probably not as big. I think the Impact Zone fits about 1,000, maybe 1,100 people. I believe they only had about 500 people here. But I love these little intimate settings. I was very disappointed, for example, back when they were doing the ECW brand in 06, and they had a few shows, or one show, I think, or whatever it was, from the Manhattan Center at the Hammerstein Ballroom here in New York City. And then they stopped doing it because they were very unhappy with the reaction that they were getting from the fans. I don't know if it was an issue of vulgarity, or I think it was just the people were not cheering for the people that they wanted them to cheer for, and vice versa. So, of course, they decided, well, we can't go back there. These fans are, you know, they're unmanageable, these people. Meanwhile, I thought that whenever they went there, which was very few times, but I thought that having shows at the Hammerstein Ballroom were some of the more fun WWE shows that they would do. It was fun. Yes, it wasn't your typical 10,000-seat arena, but you know what? You've got this intimate setting. You still have a few thousand people, but they're rabid. They're passionate. They're into the product. They're reacting. They're loud. People are walking down the aisle, and it's not like there's a mile on each side between the wrestlers and the fans. The fans are right there. They can touch the wrestlers. They can reach out and flip off the wrestlers if they want to. It's all right there. And I thought it made for a great environment. So I like these shows that are in the smaller venues. And at least for the first show, and it's only the first show. I mean, we'll see if these people are reacting this way by show number 5. I mean, look at the Impact Zone. It's been better of lately for TNA because I think the shows are live and the people are more excited about that. But one of the big problems about the Impact Zone is you never know what you're going to get. A lot of times you'll have a show or a pay-per-view there in Orlando and the crowd is dead. And these people, I think, are just they just get burned out on the product by going every single time. They may run into that problem at some point with NXT, but this was a great crowd, great setting. Jim Ross came out at the beginning. He introduced the interim general manager for NXT, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. Why he's the interim general manager, I have no idea. I guess it's a temporary arrangement, but I couldn't help but look at Jim Ross on stage interviewing Dusty Rhodes. I don't know. It was just surreal to me. I'm watching this, and I'm all excited, and I'm thinking, why is this not on TV? That thought kept running through my mind every couple of minutes I'm watching this show. So Dusty Rhodes did what I think every other general manager ought to do. He didn't overstay his welcome. He literally, the only appearance he made on this entire show, he came out at the beginning, he said hello to the fans, he said that we would have a main event of Tyson Kidd and Michael McGillicuddy. He said, you know, we're going to have a grand old time, and then he left. That was it. I don't think we ever saw him again, unless I missed something. So that, to me, is how every GM should behave. You come out, you announce the main event or something big that's going to be happening on the show, and you get the hell out of there, and you let the wrestlers go out there and do their thing. That's the way to do it. We had Bo Dallas wrestled on this show. He is Bo Rotundo, the son of IRS, Irwin R. Scheister, Mr. Mike Rotundo. Again, why he's not allowed to use his last name is it's flabbergasting to me. Two times on this show, Bo Dallas comes out, and they talk about the fact that he is the son of IRS. It's not like they're trying to hide that from us. They're telling us this is IRS's son, Mike Rotundo. Why would you not let him use his last name? Michael McGillicuddy came out for the main event. They talked about his father, Mr. Perfect, the great late Kurt Hennig, and his grandfather, Larry the Axe Hennig. Well, aren't there people at home watching this going, well, why the fuck is he called Michael McGillicuddy? Why can't he just be Joe Hennig, or hell, call him Mike Hennig? I mean, it's kind of a bland name, but I don't know. I don't know. I've been through this before, but it still boggles my mind. But Bo Dallas had a match. He was fine. I saw him live, actually, against Antonio Cesaro at Access in Miami. They had a couple of FCW matches during the Fan Fest stuff. We were right there, front row ringside. There was a little crowd that gathered for some of the FCW matches, and he was in the first one, and he actually beat Cesaro, if I remember correctly, in the opener, which people were not happy about. A lot of Claudio Castagnoli fans in Miami that did not like seeing this young kid beat him, but he's okay. He's fine. I see where people are giving him some grief because he's got the really long hair and stuff. I think it works for him just because things in wrestling today seem so homogenized. Everybody looks the same. Everyone's got the short haircut. You don't see a lot of guys lately, I think, with really long hair like this guy does. It kind of makes him stand out. So if he's going to be that kind of white meat, bread and butter babyface that comes out smiling and, you know, trying to get the fans into it and behind him and everything, I think it's fine. They aired a couple of promos throughout the show for guys that'll be appearing next week and in the weeks to come. They actually had an Antonio Cesaro promo that was great. The Cesaro taped vignette they had for him with the music and everything, this was great. You got to check that out if you didn't see it. He'll be on the show next week, I believe. They had a Bray Wyatt promo. No Eli Cottonwood with him because Eli Cottonwood has requested his release, and Eli Cottonwood is gone. He is out of wrestling. He is gone from FCW. The very first Bray Wyatt vignette that I had seen on YouTube many weeks ago, he was kind of in the background as Husky Harris's bodyguard, and I guess he is no more, but this was a new Bray Wyatt promo, very well done. It showed him somewhere in the wilderness or in the woods, just being very creepy, doing his Waylon Mercy-esque character. He's very good at it. Again, I think he's ready. Quite frankly, I'm no talent scout. I'm sure they know more than I do. But you know, he was on TV once before. He was with the Nexus, and I liked him then because he was different. He doesn't have the typical, you know, ripped to shreds physique of some bodybuilder or anything. He's this big husky kid. That's why he was called Husky Harris, who went in there. I think they used to call him like an army tank with legs or something. And he would go in there and he would beat people up. And he was actually pretty good, too. He was a pretty good wrestler on top of that. He had already been in developmental for a while. So then they sent him back down. Apparently they didn't like his physique or he was gaining too much weight. Well, he lost a little bit of weight. Now he has a new character, which is fine because I think the character is really interesting. So how long they're going to keep him down there before they bring him up, I don't know. But, I mean, God, we can use some compelling characters on television. I think that's why AJ Lee has been so refreshing on Raw and SmackDown of late, because she's playing this wacky, psychotic female character, which is a lot like the old Mickie James character, but it's different. You know, it's unique. It's something that we're not used to seeing, I think, lately on WWE TV. This character also seems very creepy and unique and interesting, and hopefully he'll be on television soon enough. We also got a promo on the show for Seth Rollins, the former Tyler Black from Ring of Honor, who's been down in developmental for quite a while. I think he is or was the FCW champion. He also, apparently, in addition to another Ring of Honor alumni, Cesaro, Rollins will be on FCW next week. Apparently he has dyed half of his hair blonde, so half of it is blonde, the other half is black. Kind of a unique look. He I think is probably, well, I guess you could put Dean Ambrose up there with him, but he's got to be in the top two or three guys in developmental right now who are probably ready to come up to TV right now. So much like Bray Wyatt and some of these other guys, I think it's only a matter of time before we see him on TV, but he'll be making his NXT debut next week. No mention, by the way, on this show of Dean Ambrose. I think Ambrose is somebody who I wouldn't expect to see him on NXT at any point. I think he probably is going to be the next guy we see debut on the main roster, on a Raw or a SmackDown. It's just a matter of when. But yeah, Rollins will be on the show next week. Speaking of new guys, another promo. This was apparently based on the reaction many of you guys had to it and posting on my Facebook page and everything. You really liked this. Was that promo from The Ascension. The Ascension is a new team in WWE, one of whom, by the way, is made up of Conor O'Brien. Conor O'Brien was on one of the seasons of NXT a few years ago. Well, I guess it's within the last 2 years. I just remember seeing Conor O'Brien when he was on NXT, and I just thought to myself, this guy doesn't really do anything for me. But give him a character that he can get into, give him a compelling character, and it really can have a tremendous effect. And let's just say that watching this promo, I was very intrigued to see the Ascension. This was very well done. I guess they're like a bunch of vampires or something, and they shot it where it looked as though they were standing on top of a building somewhere with the sky in the background, and they were being really creepy and really vampire-ish. And then they had a match. The promo led to an actual match on this show. They came out. It was the Ascension against Mike Dalton and CJ Parker. I don't think Mr. Dalton even made it into the ring. This was about a minute long, and the Ascension won. So nice to see tag teams being brought up. Rarely do I hear anything really about tag teams down in FCW. I hear about all these singles guys like Rollins and Cesaro and Ambrose and Richie Steamboat and Bo Dallas, but I never hear about tag teams. So it's good to see that there are a few down there that they are planning to at some point bring up. So I enjoyed their act. It's the first time I've seen them or heard of them. I can't really give my opinion on how big they could be. I had one guy email me and go, "Oh, this is great. I think they ought to bring them in as like minions of the Undertaker." Let's just not get ahead of ourselves here. I think, first of all, that's not going to happen, number one. Number two, I seen one promo and one match. A match that went 60 seconds. I think it's a little too early to say that these guys ought to be put with The Undertaker on WWE TV. So we had, what else did we have on this show? That pretty much led to the main event. They did have this little backstage skit with Derek Bateman and Johnny Curtis, who apparently are going to have a match. I think they're in the main event next week on NXT. And speaking of main events, we had, as I mentioned, Michael McGillicuddy and Tyson Kidd in the main event on this show. A very, very good match that went a good 15 or 20 minutes. Tyson Kidd wins. He used his dungeon lock to get the tap out. And there you go. That was it. It was a fine professional wrestling show. They tried to get a lot of new guys over, some young guys over. They had some pretty cool vignettes. Again, if you didn't see the Cesaro vignette or the Ascension vignette, you ought to go check it out. Those are on YouTube. You can easily find them if you just type them in. Or you may find links to them on my Facebook page. So check it out. Thoroughly enjoyed NXT this week. Hopefully it'll be uploaded by another fine YouTube user at some point this week, and I'll be able to see episode 2. And if so, I will be sure to talk about it here on the show next week. Who would have thunk that I would ever be reviewing NXT on the Sound Off? But there you go. That might have actually been the best wrestling show of the week, and I'm not even joking about that. That leads us to Monday Night Raw. Monday Night Raw from the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. Raw was in my backyard this week, much like the pay-per-view was. I have seen many a WWE show there, and this was not one of them. I was working on this night, so I watched the show on DVR when I got home, and this show is much easier to tolerate at 2 hours and three. I mean, that really struck me watching this. I'm not looking forward to these three-hour shows. The big news is that each week, until the board of directors can find a permanent replacement for John Laurinaitis as the GM, they will be bringing back an old general manager to host both Raw and SmackDown. And this week it was Long Island's own Mick Foley, who was actually wearing a suit and tie and not his trademark flannel shirt. I think it would be more appropriate for him to come out wearing a flannel suit, personally. Just kind of merge the two together. I think next week, Vicky Guerrero, this week I should say, is going to be the GM for Raw and SmackDown. So if you're not a fan of Vicky, you probably won't be a fan of these shows. We also had John Laurinaitis on Raw this week. He was back. Yes, the same John Laurinaitis that had been fired less than 24 hours earlier was back on this program. He said that he was there to give his farewell address. Well, that's awfully nice of WWE. I hope if I ever get fired from my job, they have the courtesy to allow me to return the next day and address all of my former colleagues. I can excuse WWE for this stupidity because, you know what? It's not that big of a deal. But then came the whopper. Then came the whopper. Not only was Laurinaitis allowed back on TV to give a farewell address, but he revealed that before he was fired, he had already signed a match for Raw, pitting John Cena against himself, David Otunga, and The Big Show. Forget the fact that it's yet another Raw main event featuring David Otunga. I have ranted about that enough. I don't hate Otunga, by the way. I think he can be quite entertaining in his role. But how many times can we see this fucking guy job to John Cena in the main event? I feel like I've seen this match, you know, years ago we complained about how many John Cena-Randy Orton matches we had seen. I feel like we're approaching John Cena-Randy Orton territory here with all the matches that Cena has had with Otunga. Just far too many. But forget that. The absurdity of this entire scenario cannot be ignored. The man lost his job. Why wouldn't the board of directors just say, fuck you, you have no power anymore, hit the bricks? Why would his authority extend to this show after he has already been fired? What's worse is that the board of directors is still forcing him to wrestle on house shows and handicap matches with The Big Show and I think Tensai against John Cena. How do you force somebody that has been fired to continue working? I don't understand this. And Laurinaitis is backstage on this show in segments with Otunga. He's laughing. He's palling around with him. He's all jolly. He doesn't look like a guy who just lost his job. Why would he even make a match involving John Cena if the stipulation was that John Cena would be fired if he lost on Sunday? Boy, that's great confidence that Laurinaitis has in The Big Show there. This whole storyline is so goddamn stupid. It's so much dumber than the AJ Dixie Carter stuff on Impact. It is. I mean, at least that one, you don't have people who were fired still showing up on TV. Although in that one, you can't argue in that one, why doesn't Dixie Carter just fire Christopher Daniels and Kazarian? That is true. But I still say the storyline is far dumber. It just is so stupid. So stupid. They announced on this show that the Brazilian flag destroyer, Chris Jericho, will be making his return to Raw this coming Monday. By the way, I fully endorse that as his new nickname, the Brazilian flag destroyer. They showed clips of Jericho performing with Fozzy in front of a large crowd somewhere. It sure made it seem like he would be back as a babyface. At least that was the impression I got by watching this. His suspension, by the way, officially ended on Friday, and interestingly enough, keep this in the back of your mind, Rey Mysterio's suspension officially ends on Monday. That would be tomorrow as I am recording this. So I'm not saying he'll be on Raw this week, but I think it's safe to say he'll be popping back up on TV any day now. The greatest sign ever goes to the dude on this show holding up the sign that read, Kamala owes me a dollar. Maybe it was because I was watching this show after midnight and I was completely exhausted and I just... the slightest thing maybe I would find funny, but I just thought that was hilarious. That person deserves a thumbs up for making that sign. Alberto Del Rio, I'm just going through some of the key things on this show. I'm not reviewing the whole thing. Alberto Del Rio beat Santino in about 30 seconds, which is significant. I bring it up because that means Del Rio beat both the United States champion and the Intercontinental champion in the same week. And didn't win either title, which just makes those titles look completely worthless. So I just thought I would bring that up. We had Paul Heyman making an appearance on this show, his first in many weeks, to inform Triple H that, in fact, Brock Lesnar does not accept his challenge for SummerSlam. This almost went down as the greatest promo of all time, because most of the time when someone comes out for an interview like this, it takes them 20 minutes to say what can be said in about five. You know, here Heyman literally walked out. He turned down Triple H, he said goodbye, and he went to leave. Great! He made his point. Unfortunately, Triple H had to interrupt, and so this was not the greatest promo of all time. Heyman got under Triple H's skin, he challenged Hunter to hit him again, he dared him to. And he said that he's already got two lawsuits against the company. If Triple H hits him again, he and Brock will own this company. And see, now that would be one hell of a storyline right there. Actually, Triple H did hit Heyman, which makes him, first of all, the world's worst executive. I mean, if that's any indication of his decision-making ability, once Vince McMahon kicks the bucket, this company is in big trouble. But you know what? Maybe that's the direction they're going in. Maybe now Heyman and Lesnar will ask that control of the company be put on the line in a match at SummerSlam between Brock and Hunter, and then he accepts. It doesn't matter since Triple H is winning, of course, but that at least would make the match mean so much more. Something tangible, something big would be on the line, you know? They've got to do something fast with this, because I'm getting really bored with this whole storyline. I mean, it's a bunch of guys yakking about lawsuits. Who cares? Who gives a shit? I mean, when Brock came back, I was excited, because I wanted to see him go around killing people and being Brock Lesnar, not sending people out on his behalf to make legal threats. I mean, I don't know that we're going to see Lesnar at all, quite frankly, until July 23rd, which is the Raw 1000 show. I do think we'll see him there. He ought to come out and destroy DX is what he should do. You know, just leave Shawn Michaels laying in a pool of his own blood, or better yet, since they don't like blood, just get Brock to get his hold over by breaking Shawn's arm with the key lock or the Kimura, whatever they're calling it these days. You know? He's not going to be on television, Shawn Michaels says, for a while, I'm sure, after that July 23rd show. He'll probably just disappear again, so why not break his arm? Get the hold over, get the match over. We had a segment on the show featuring Cyndi Lauper, Wendi Richter, and Rowdy Roddy Piper. Let me repeat that. Cyndi Lauper, Wendi Richter, and Rowdy Roddy Piper. It is 2012. You need not check your calendars. It is not 1984. This whole thing just came out of nowhere. Apparently, Cyndi Lauper has a new album out that she is promoting, hence the reason for this appearance. Why is she not in the celebrity wing of the WWE Hall of Fame? I mean, really, if you were to pick the celebrities that actually deserve a spot in there, Cyndi Lauper, Mr. T, Mike Tyson, and I'd say even Donald Trump, all deserve to be in there. They all had a significantly positive impact on business for the company. In some cases, arguably, they helped keep the company alive. Instead, we have Drew fucking Carey in the Hall of Fame. Go figure. I was actually shocked to see Wendi Richter out there on this show. Not gonna lie. We all know the story about her departure from the company back in the 80s when she was the women's champion. Long before the Montreal Screwjob, there was Spider Lady, which was the fabulous Moolah in a costume. She was shooting on Richter. Well, at the end she did anyway. She pinned her by the order of Vince McMahon, took the championship. Richter never did return to the company. And while they did put her in the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago, she has had some horrible things to say about WWE and Vince McMahon in recent years. But money talks, I suppose. There she was, jogging down to the ring with Richter, with Lauper, I should say. Most people in the crowd had absolutely no idea who they were, or at least Richter they didn't, which is not surprising. They were interrupted by Heath Slater. Slater called this segment a train wreck, and he started to sing very badly. That's when Piper came out. He got a great reaction. He apologized to Cyndi Lauper for being a dick to her all those years ago and presented her with a gold record, similar to the one that Piper famously smashed over the head of the late Captain Lou Albano. Slater started to sing again, so Piper poked him in the eye. Lauper then shattered the record over his head. He was actually busted open hard way from the blow. So who would have thunk it? Of all the people on the show, Cyndi Lauper is the one who actually gets color on someone at a time when they don't allow blood in WWE. That was the entire segment. That's it, right there. Really, it was just a colossal waste of time. But as somebody who grew up around that time period and does remember these folks, it was a nice bit of nostalgia, even if it did fall flat with the live crowd. But here's the real reason I hated this segment. It was clear to me that Vince McMahon instructed the announcers, in particular Michael Cole, to bury this segment. Okay? Cole was just going on and on and on about how terrible it was. He was laughing at it. You know, why Vince McMahon would even have a segment on his television program that he thinks sucks and isn't getting over and then instruct his lead announcer to crap all over it is a question that I can't answer. It's like, for all of the good things the company does do, and the Hall of Fame stuff and all that, I mean, they show a great deal of reverence and respect to the legends when they want to. But for all of that, they do so much to disrespect these same legends and make a mockery out of them that as a fan, I find it insulting. But that's not even what irritated me about this segment. What irritated me about this segment was that Michael Cole has a nasty little habit. I'm not sure if anybody else has picked up on this. I'm sure you have. Whenever Michael Cole is forced to fake laugh during one of these segments, he has this habit of snorting. Like every 5 seconds. And I don't mean cocaine. Although the way he acts on this show, maybe he is snorting some coke backstage before the show. But he snorted so many goddamn times during this segment, I wanted to throw my remote through the TV screen. It was like nails on a chalkboard. I cannot stand it when he does that. And he did it all throughout this entire segment. If he's going to fake laugh during these things, he has got to stop with the snorting. It's just, he was ungodly annoying here. It's just little things like that that he does or is instructed to do that just, I could see where it actually does turn viewers away. It almost turned me away. It seems like such a minor thing. Oh, why would you nitpick and complain? It's fucking annoying, that's why. I just want him to stop snorting, please. I'd rather he snort coke than snort on this show the way that he does. Main event was John Cena overcoming the odds against the Laurinaitis, Big Show, and Otunga. Big Show actually never even wrestled. He told Johnny that he had his ironclad contract and was no longer beholden to him, so he left. Otunga stayed loyal to Laurinaitis at first, but whenever he would try to tag out, Johnny would kind of back off, and he would be like, oh, I'm too injured to fight, and he pretty much left Otunga in there to die. Otunga managed to get the upper hand on Cena at one point during the match. Laurinaitis all of a sudden found his courage. He asked for the tag. He came in. He stomped on John Cena for a little bit, tried for the pin. Cena kicked out. So Johnny went to tag back out to Otunga. And Otunga, seeing that Laurinaitis wasn't really injured at all, decided to leave him high and dry. He had had enough. Cena then beat up Laurinaitis for a bit. He gave him three FUs. He pinned him. And that, we were told, was the true end of people power. Why should I believe them when they say that? I don't believe them at all. I mean, I'm pretty sure that we have not seen the last of this man. Maybe for a while, but he'll be back. The fans loved the finish because they absolutely hated Laurinaitis. So they hated him so much, they just loved seeing him get his ass kicked. The character had a lot of heat. It's just too bad they couldn't figure out a way to actually generate business with it. That's why this whole thing was such a failure, this whole storyline. It's not like people were buying tickets to see John Laurinaitis get his butt kicked, or the ratings were soaring during his segments because people so badly wanted to see him get his ass kicked, or the buy rate for Over the Limit, his match with John Cena was like record-setting or anything like that. Not at all. I mean, people were actually turning off the product in droves during this entire storyline. So it's like I said, though, it's too bad because he was so bad in his role that he was good. He definitely had heat. It just, like I said, didn't translate into any business for the company. So that was Raw Monday Night. I've seen worse shows. This one was not that good. But let's talk about Impact, actually. Impact Wrestling, another live episode. I believe this was live episode number 3 on Thursday night from the Impact Zone. They can't all be winners. This Impact was a step down from the past 2 weeks. I didn't think it was all that bad. In fact, I still think Impact was probably a better show than Raw, again. But it just felt like there was way too much going on. It was open fight night, so we had all of these Bound for Glory series matches with random people just walking out and challenging someone from the back. I don't know, I just think that there were way too many matches on this show that went like 2 or 3 minutes. If you have fewer matches that went a little bit longer, I think it would have been a lot better. It felt like we had like 12 matches on the show. I don't think we did legitimately, but it felt like we had like 12 matches on the show. It got old after a while. The concept of open fight night, I like, especially if they keep it to once a month. You can't do it more than that. But why does Gut Check have to be on the same night? Why not separate the two? Maybe that's part of why it felt like they were throwing so much stuff at us on this show. Maybe do it a different night. You can't say that the Bound for Glory series matches don't mean anything, because they do. You know, you get a certain amount of points for winning your match, and that helps your standing in the tournament. So they're actually giving you a reason to care about these 3-minute matches, which is more than I can say for the 3-minute matches that we get on Monday nights. So I will give them credit for that. The big news on this show actually was, there was a lot that happened. First, Austin Aries did in fact surrender his X Division title to Hulk Hogan in exchange for a shot at Bobby Roode's World Heavyweight Championship at Destination X, which is their next pay-per-view coming up. I believe July 8th is the date. Actually, Aries will continue to hold on to the title until the day of the pay-per-view, but will officially relinquish it at that point. And I said last week, if they wanted to really make the X title mean even more than it does to feel really special, they should have Austin Aries turn down Hulk Hogan's offer and keep the championship while telling him that, you know what, I know how good I am, and I can earn a shot at the world title on my own merits whenever I want to, but he didn't do that. What they did here was kind of clever, in that Aries came up with an option C. And by the way, there was an option C chant from the crowd at one point, which I think is a first. Aries said that he would give up the title so long as, from that point forward, every year, whoever the X Division champion was, that person would have the option of giving up the title in exchange for a shot at the world title at Destination X. He wanted to start a precedent. It's basically their version of Money in the Bank, which I think is actually totally overdone. in WWE, but that's partially because they have two Money in the Bank matches every year on the same show, which is ridiculous. At least here, once a year, you're giving one champion the opportunity to move up the ladder. Hogan agreed. He thought this was a fine idea, and the two men shook hands. So a nice little twist there, I think, that does make the X Division title mean more than it does. Although, you can also take the other point of view on this, which is that every year, you're just going to have somebody give up the X title to go after the world title, which renders the X Division title less valuable. But in reality, the X title should be less valuable than your world championship. So I'm actually okay with this. What I wasn't okay with was the other big angle on this show, the reveal at the end with AJ Styles, Dixie Carter, and this mystery woman. First, let me just get this out of the way and say that this segment sucked, okay? This segment sucked. If the Cyndi Lauper segment on Raw was train wreck television, this was a nuclear disaster, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, this is not the end of the storyline. This was a plot twist, and I hope that in the end, they have a really good payoff for this thing. But my God, did this segment suck. To recap, and I hope I'm not missing anything when I do, AJ and Dixie have been totally stressed out about whether or not they should come clean. Come clean about what? I don't know. Whatever their big secret was, it was so horrible that Dixie apparently couldn't even tell her husband, Serge, which was evident by the show last week when Serge punched AJ Styles in the face, thinking, I guess, that he was apparently having triple X division matches behind closed doors with Dixie. So they also kept telling people that people are going to get hurt. That's all we kept hearing. Oh, we have to come clean, but I know that people are going to get hurt, but we have to do it. Okay, so they said people are going to get hurt. So they come out, all ready to do the big reveal, when who should run down to the ring but Claire Lynch? Now, you may be thinking to yourself, who the fuck is Claire Lynch? And that would be a fair question, because nobody knows who she is. She's never appeared on the show before, not once. But this woman was all bent out of shape. She actually, come to think of it, she may literally be out of shape. I couldn't tell if she was pregnant or just fat. I assume pregnant, and it's going to play into the storyline going forward, but if not, she needs to lay off the Cheetos. Anyway, she was pretending to cry, although I didn't see any tears. Eve Torres can cry on command when the fans call her a hosky, so I'm not quite sure why this woman can't cry on command. She said AJ and Dixie are, in fact, not having an affair, which the crowd seemed disappointed in. I guess Kane now is more of a pimp than AJ is. I mean, did you see that kiss that Kane planted on AJ at No Way Out? AJ Lee, that is. I forgot there's another AJ here. I'm talking about AJ Lee, not AJ Styles. AJ Styles did not swap spit with Kane at the pay-per-view. You see, this is why we can't have two people with the same name during concurrent storylines in WWE and TNA. I'm all confused now. Anyway, Claire Lynch said that there's been no affair between AJ and Dixie, but that she is an addict who is trying to get clean. She has a drinking problem, a drug problem. I think we may have just found CM Punk's sister with this storyline here, by the way. So she went to AJ and Dixie for support for her her drug and alcohol habit. Why them? I have no idea. Why not go to Punk? Why not go to her brother? I don't know. Many fans in the crowd, they started a what chant during this speech, which may have actually been the only time in the history of the world that that chant made sense. I was saying that out loud to myself at home. That's all I kept saying is, what? You know, if she is pregnant, I just thought to myself, if this woman is pregnant and has been doing drugs, I guess that makes this poor kid a crack baby, possibly. This could be a crack baby that she's carrying around with her. Backstage, Christopher Daniels was all upset. He pretended, it looked as though he knew who the girl was. He was sitting there watching this on the monitor saying, no, 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 she's saying too much. What is she saying? And then he and Kazarian ran down to the ring. AJ Styles proceeded to beat the ever-loving shit out of these two men. He gave Frankie Kazarian this awesome powerbomb that just looked like he broke him in half. I mean, he powerbombed the shit out of him. And then he nailed Daniels with the Pele kick, which I hated, by the way. It's just such a dumb move to begin with, but in the context of a real fight, why the hell would you bust out a Pele kick? You know, AJ Styles is so upset with these guys. They're not in the middle of a wrestling match. They ran out there. This guy has sullied his reputation. AJ Styles has a wife who perhaps now he has problems with, because Christopher Daniels has been coming out week after week alleging that he's been having an affair, AJ has, with his boss. I mean, if I'm AJ Styles, I'd be very pissed off at this guy. I wouldn't stand there and flip my body and contort my body and give him a fucking Pele kick. I'd smack him in the mouth and I would take him down and do some ground and pound. That's what I would do. But not AJ Styles. And the show went off the air with more questions than answers, which is actually the prime ingredient of a good cliffhanger. But this may have turned off more viewers than anything else. The acting here was so hokey, and the story itself just made very little sense. Everything about this was just a complete letdown. And we'll see what they do this week on Impact. I'm willing to give them one more chance to redeem themselves with this storyline, but this was just an epic fail. It just reminded me of something that Vince Russo would write. And when something is on television that makes me go, huh, I wonder if Russo wrote this, it's probably not a good thing. So this was no good. Also on this show, we had they had the Gut Check Challenge. And for the first time, they had a female Gut Check performer by the name of Taylor Hendricks. She apparently is, I think she's 23 years old, pretty girl. They played some solemn music at one point during this video package when they told us that, and she told us that she had been diagnosed with cancer at 21. And, you know, it's one of those things that kind of pulls at the heartstrings. Oh, my goodness, somebody so young being diagnosed with cancer. They didn't say what kind of cancer. But I bring this up because I read online, and I read in certain places, reliable sources that I trust, that she never actually had cancer. Apparently what happened is this girl was misdiagnosed as having cancer. I don't know when she found out she actually didn't have cancer, and I don't know whether to blame her or TNA. I don't want to blame the girl because it's very easy to kind of distort what people say in the context of editing an interview or putting a video package together. Maybe when she talked on camera, she made it very clear that she was diagnosed with cancer but never actually had it, but it was a scary experience. The way that they kind of edited this whole thing together based on what she was saying, it sure did make it sound like they were trying to get sympathy for this girl by making it clearly sound as though she had cancer and beat it, even though they never came out and said that. That was the impression as a viewer that I was left with until I went online and read that she actually never had cancer. So if that's the case, if that was TNA's fault, shame on them, because that, trying to get sympathy for this girl, I'm sure it was a very scary experience for her. You know, being told that you have cancer, even though it turned out that it sounds as though she never really did. But if that was TNA's way of trying to get sympathy for this girl, then that was a fucking low-class move on their part, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I personally know a lot of people that have had cancer from within my own family and other people, friends and whatnot. And you know what? If this girl actually did have cancer and she's okay with talking about it, I'm fine with bringing it up because it's a great story if she had it and beat it and overcame it. But if you know that she never actually had cancer and she found out and then a couple of days or a couple of weeks later she found out she never actually did, but you kind of film it and portray it as though she did and look at her, she came back, she beat cancer and she never did, you know what? Fuck you. Because that's totally low class. And again, I don't know who's responsible for that, but I didn't like that at all. But this girl has been wrestling, she said in her video, for about 6 years. And she has potential, but are the standards for women's wrestling these days so low that everybody is willing to say, give her a contract just because she's pretty and didn't botch any moves in her match on this show with Tara? I mean, she still needs a lot of work, but for a girl that's been wrestling 6 years, she was okay. I mean, you know, her offense doesn't look terribly convincing. It looks like a love tap whenever she clotheslines somebody. You know, it just makes me think of, you know, the Sarah Del Reyes of the world, who are still not working for a major national promotion, but yet everybody online, a majority of the people I saw making comments on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and everything, yeah, give her a contract. She deserves it. She had a good match. Yeah, the match was okay. I mean, really, I think there are probably far more female performers more deserving of she is than a contract. If the whole point of Gut Check is to, you know, reward the people that you think are best prepared to be on TV and have a career for themselves and make money, in TNA. I'm sorry, but Taylor Hendricks over here doesn't exactly come across as that kind of performer. She's good, but not that good. So that was my impression. We'll find out next week what the judges think. It'll be interesting if the cancer stuff comes up at all. Because, again, I'm not willing to blame her. I have a feeling that TNA knew what they were doing when they put that video package together. And we'll see if any of that comes up next week on the show. There was not enough Joseph Park on this show. That was the other thing I wanted to make mention of here. He was in the crowd eating popcorn. Security came over. They escorted him backstage where he was confronted by an angry Bully Ray who threatened him. And it was very sad, actually, to see Joe Park get bullied by the Bully on this show. But that was it. That's all we had. We did have an Abyss appearance on this show. Later on during Bully Ray's match, he had a Bound for Glory series match with the Pope, D'Angelo De Niro, who beat Bully Ray, and beat him in part because Abyss came down and distracted Bully Ray. And in fact, when Bully Ray lost his match and lost the opportunity to gain some points in the Bound for Glory series, he didn't seem terribly distressed about it. He was more interested in getting away from Abyss, and he escaped after the match through the crowd. And I don't know, Abyss, it's weird. Obviously, we know it's Joe Park in disguise, and it looks like Joe Park these days, when he is Abyss, is wearing the Undertaker's Raggedy Ann wig. Remember that one episode of Raw when Undertaker wore the wig? He looked like Raggedy Ann. And then, of course, he cut all of his hair off. Clearly, Abyss is wearing some sort of wig, and not a very good one. And, you know, he takes his false teeth out whenever he's not portraying Joe Park, because in real life, he had his teeth knocked out in a match against RVD many, many months ago on Impact, and I guess he never had his teeth fixed. So he has a mouthful of, you know, empty teeth, no teeth. And, you know, so he wants to make himself look more like Abyss, I guess, when he's back in the Abyss character. But he was like, he was walking around with his arms outstretched like he was Frankenstein or something. It was very weird. I hate the Abyss character now. I really, if I never see Abyss again, I won't mind. He used to be, I used to like the Monster Abyss and all that, but then I saw Joe Park, and I just find that character so much more entertaining. How much of a shelf life Joe Park will have, I don't know. I mean, I love the character right now, but then again, I loved Brodus Clay in the beginning until they beat him down and didn't do anything with him, and, I mean, I like Brodus, but not nearly as much as I used to like the character, so who knows, but, I don't know, Abyss just doesn't do anything for me. He's just kind of there. He's, you know, he's got the mask on, he makes mean faces, and I don't know. If Abyss disappears and never shows up on Impact again, I will not mind. So, not enough Joseph Park on this show is a fail, as far as I'm concerned. As far as the Sting stuff from last week, remember Sting at the end of Impact last Thursday was viciously attacked by three masked individuals. And the only mention of that on the show this week was at the beginning when Hulk Hogan came out. He briefly made mention of what happened. He didn't want to give any publicity to the attackers, so he wasn't going to talk about it, even though he was, you know, talking about it. But he said that they were going to find out who they were and whatever, and that was it. They really, other than that brief mention, no mention was made of Sting, no mention was made of his physical condition, if he's okay or anything like that. So, I don't know. I guess the masked attackers, maybe they kidnapped Sting like they kidnapped Samoa Joe. Remember when Samoa Joe got kidnapped? I don't think we ever had a resolution to that storyline either. Maybe it's the same people. I mean, if that's the case, hopefully they return Sting in time for his Hall of Fame induction at Bound for Glory. That would suck if Bound for Glory came and, you know, yeah, sometimes at these award shows, the person can't be there to accept their awards, so somebody else goes up there and says, to accept on so-and-so's behalf. I could see Dixie Carter going up there in October. I'm here to accept on Sting's behalf, because you see, he was kidnapped 4 months ago, and we don't really give a shit, so we don't know where he is. So hopefully he's okay. Another thing on this show I just wanted to mention really quickly here. Again, they had a whole bunch of Bound for Glory series matches. Mr. Anderson beat Christopher Daniels, and they had a match where Robbie E, it's open fight night, you see, so Robbie E comes down and challenges anybody in the back, which was a mistake on his part because Kurt Angle accepted his challenge, and Kurt Angle made very short work of Robbie E on this show and gave him a German suplex, a couple of German suplexes, gave him an angle slam, and then an ankle lock, immediately fell to the mat and leg vined his leg, and once Angle gets you in the leg vine, you know it's over. And Robbie E tapped out, Kurt Angle celebrated, and went right back to the locker room. So a fine performance by Kurt Angle here, who earned, I guess with that submission win, you get 10 points for a submission. So Kurt Angle got 10 points. I believe that was the Bound for Glory series match. I'm pretty sure it was. So that was fine. There was also a Bound for Glory series match on the show. Samoa Joe came out to challenge James Storm. James Storm beat him with the super kick. There was a nice little thing in this match. Joe was going for his muscle buster in the corner, and then realized that for a submission you get 10 points, for a pinfall you only get 7. And so he kind of threw James Storm down and went to put him in the choke, or a sleeper hold, I think maybe it was, which obviously backfired. Again, Joe lost. Joe always loses. I think Samoa Joe's new theme music ought to be the blues. Samoa Joe should come to the ring to the blues. I think that music would fit him perfectly. But the thing, back to Kurt Angle for a second here. So he beats Robbie E on this show. Very quick match. Make short work of him. And I think while Impact was going on, or maybe it was right after the show, on Twitter, Kurt Angle is all but campaigning for a job with WWE. You know, he's tweeting about, I don't know, he's tweeting some nonsense about how he's the best and not CM Punk and not John Cena. And again, we know that WWE is the number one game in town. TNA is just not as big as WWE may never be. But they've got a lot of momentum of late. I mean, hell, I'm watching Impact, okay? I can't tell you the last time I consistently watched Impact week after week after week. So they're doing something right. There's momentum. There's hope, okay? On most weeks now, Impact is better than Raw, quite frankly. But there's Kurt Angle on Twitter, right? One of the top stars in TNA. And what is he tweeting about? He's not tweeting about the top stars in TNA like Sting or Jeff Hardy or Bobby Roode or James Storm or Samoa Joe. He's tweeting about CM Punk and Randy Orton and John Cena. And it's like, really, dude? You're in TNA. Just suck it up. You're in TNA. Talk about TNA. Don't worry about tweeting about the WWE guys. Just, I don't know. Just rubbed me the wrong way, and it was kind of sad because it came across to me like he's campaigning to go back there. I mean, he's always constantly, he's retweeting these comments from other people about, oh my God, Kurt, I wish you would go back to WWE and be at WrestleMania 29, or, you know, they're doing this gimmick now where old GMs are coming back. Kurt, you're the best GM when you were the GM of SmackDown. You should come back next week. He's retweeting all these other comments from other people. It's like, could you make it any more obvious? You know what I mean? But somebody actually made a great comment. They said that to me on Twitter. I forgot who it was. This great comment. They said, well, you know, in his defense, after that last segment in the main event on Impact, wouldn't you be campaigning for a job with WWE? And I had, my only response to that was, touche. You make a very good point there. The only other comment from Impact I have, Jeff Hardy and Rob Van Dam had a match. They were the two odd men out. Open fight night. Nobody picked them. So they were the only two guys without a match, and Hulk Hogan made the match. They had a good match, and Rob Van Dam busted out a 450 splash in this match. I don't think I've ever seen Rob Van Dam pull that move off before, but here he is at the age of 40, or almost 40. Clearly he's lost a few steps, but there's RVD up top doing a 450 splash, so he's got my respect. He pulled it off too, except the only problem is he missed. Jeff Hardy rolled out of the way. Jeff Hardy did get the win, by the way, with the twist of fate. He gave him two twists of fate. And the way that Rob sells these things, just like he used to sell the pile driver, he's great. I mean, he in a way, he kind of oversells it, but he sells it in a realistic enough manner where it looks brutal. And this twist of fate looked brutal, and Jeff got the pin, and it was a good match. So, again, not a bad Impact show. A step down from the last 2 weeks for sure, and that main event segment sucked. It sucked the life out of the show. It sucked the life out of me. That's how bad it was. They better have something good planned for next week. That's all I got to say about that. A couple of other TNA notes here really quick. They filed a lawsuit this week to silence Scott Steiner. Scott Steiner has been he's been commenting about Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff and Brooke Hogan and having some, well, let's just say unsavory things to say about them on Twitter. And TNA has had enough. As if their lawsuit they filed against WWE wasn't enough. They're lawsuit happy all of a sudden. TNA's filing lawsuits against everybody. They may file a lawsuit against me if I say bad things about Impact. And to that, by the way, I say good luck. But they filed a lawsuit against Scott Steiner, and they're trying to shut him up. I don't know what the damages are that they're trying to recoup in some form or fashion. They did note that Steiner signed a contract with the company back in December of 2010 to appear exclusively for the promotion, and there were some other stipulations in that contract that actually gave the pay for his appearances. He was being paid $2,000 for, I guess, normal events and $2,500 for pay-per-views, plus he got some royalties as part of his deal as well. But there was an agreement, apparently, that Steiner would not make any statements that disparaged TNA in any way or cast them in a negative light. Whether or not that agreement would extend to Twitter here in 2012 on a contract that he signed in 2010, I don't know. I guess that'll come out in due time. I think Steiner has been quiet since this was filed, as you might imagine. So they're not very happy. I think what happened, quite frankly, Scott Steiner said that he was going to reveal some stuff about Eric Bischoff from the Gold Club trial. There was a case or a trial of some kind back in the 90s during the boom period or right around that time. Eric Bischoff, I guess, was a frequent guest at the Gold Clubs. I don't know if it was a porn a strip club or what it was. But there were things that were out there about Bischoff and the Gold Club and his wife, I think, allegedly making out with one of the strippers or something like that. And Steiner was revealing some stuff on Twitter about sexual preferences that Bischoff and his wife had based on testimony that was given in the Gold Club trial. And I think what happened is as soon as he said that, that set Bischoff off. And Bischoff just said, sick the dogs on this guy. We've got to shut him up. Because he's been making general comments about how bad Bischoff and Hogan have been for TNA and how bad Brooke Hogan is and how unhappy people are behind the scenes, which may or may not be true. I mean, I know now people are kind of supposedly behind the scenes. People are very excited with Impact going live and everything. But he's making all these different comments for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then he made the comments about Bischoff and the Gold Club. And I'm willing to bet that that was kind of the nail in his coffin there. That really got under some people's skin, if you know what I mean. So that's the deal with Scott Steiner and TNA. Chris Sabin is going to have surgery for his torn left ACL. I believe his surgery is scheduled for July 6th. And it's the same kind of surgery he had on his other knee. That surgery kept him out almost a year. And they're predicting that this surgery would keep him out for about 6 to 9 months. So he's going to be gone for a while. Again, sucks for him. I mean, imagine just having to be away from what you love doing and being out of action for that long and having to go through the rehab and then coming back and almost immediately going down with the same injury in the other knee, knowing that you're going to be on this long road to recovery, all the rehab you've got to go through, it's going to be at least 8 or 9 months, I'm willing to bet. It just sucks for him. So that's the update on Chris Sabin. And Slammiversary, which I said was a very good show, one of my favorite pay-per-view shows of the year, apparently did very well by TNA standards. Again, by any other standards, the show absolutely bombed. But when a typical TNA pay-per-view does 7,000-8,000 buys, and you have one that does about 15,000 buys, which I think is double what Slammiversary did last June, that's pretty good. So apparently Slammiversary did about 15,000 pay-per-view buys thereabout. And I know TNA is a private company, much like UFC, by the way. They don't outright reveal their pay-per-view numbers, but these numbers still do get out. Just like the UFC pay-per-views, you know. UFC is not a publicly traded company. They're under no obligation to tell people how their pay-per-views do, but the numbers get out from within the industry. And Slammiversary did pretty well. And I'm happy about that, actually. I'm happy for TNA, because Slammiversary was a hell of a show. So when you actually put on a great show, I want those shows to do well. I hope people watch that show and perhaps it convinced them to check out the next TNA pay-per-view, which hopefully will be equally as good. So thumbs up to them on that. Let's get to a couple of shout-outs here really quick. Josh from Melbourne, Australia writes, and by the way, you can email me your shout-outs and questions at thesolomonster@gmail.com. So this is Josh from Melbourne. He writes in. He says, I celebrated my 15th birthday on June 18th. Could I get a shout-out? Well, you certainly can. Happy birthday, Josh. He also wants to know if I think Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, or Owen Hart would have had a run, or another run in some cases, with the WWE title had they not died. I think it's safe to say that at least one of them would have, just with the frequency with which title changes happen these days. Thankfully, CM Punk has held on to the title for about 8 months now, but that's a rare feat. So I think Eddie would have for sure. Owen, I am not so sure about Owen, but I think Eddie absolutely, I think, would have been champion again. Valentino from Scotland says, can you please give me an encouraging shout-out? Because luck is for losers, he says. As on Sunday, I am competing in the Europe Cadet Judo Championships in Montenegro. So, good luck, Valentino. That sounds pretty cool. Just stay away from Ronda Rousey with that judo stuff, or you'll end up a one-armed man. He also wants to know my thoughts on the team of Paul London and Brian Kendrick. He says, I thought when they were on SmackDown from 2005 to 2007, they were awesome and made a shit show worth watching. I remember when they dropped the titles to Deuce and Domino, I was angry because, to my recollection, Deuce and Domino were not over in the slightest. Well, that is true. And not only that, but I think London and Kendrick, if I remember correctly, they had what was at that point one of the longest title reigns, tag team title reigns in years in the company. And I remember thinking when it ended that they should have made a bigger deal out of it, and they didn't. So I thought they were a good team, not greatest of all time or anything like that, but they worked they worked very well together. They're a kooky bunch of people, are Brian Kendrick and Paul London. They're out there. Blackleg from the Philippines writes in, hope I can get a shout out for my best friend Carla. Her birthday is today. Happy birthday, Carla. And her daughter Kylie. Her birthday is coming up on July 4th. I am currently miles apart from them, and I cannot wait to be with them come December. They are my queen and princess, and I love them so much. So that's from Blackleg. He also wants to know my thoughts on a Damian Sandow Zack Ryder feud. And he puts the word serious in there. A serious feud between Damian Sandow and Zack Ryder. He says, I really like this idea and hope WWE will go with it. Look, I am in favor of any serious feud for Zack Ryder, because obviously, they have soured on his character and putting him in any sort of meaningless feud or meaningless storyline. Having him get more serious, especially if you play it off as Zack Ryder gets serious because he's pissed he's being overlooked. He's pissed that he's being pushed back down the card. So he gets more serious. He has a bit of a mean streak in him. The problem with that is that the Zack Ryder character, when you look at him, he looks like a goober. You know what I mean? He looks like a giant, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, he's from another dimension or something like that. He's got the headband and, you know, the spiky hair and, you know, woo, woo, woo. And, you know, that's what got him over. But if you want to get him serious, I think you then have to tweak the character, because the current character is not meant to be taken seriously. Just look at the guy. It's like looking at Robbie E on Impact, who basically portrays the exact same character. This Jersey Shore knockoff, and he calls people gerbils and whatever the hell else he does. You can't take a character like that seriously. The guy either has to come out to do a, quote, shoot promo one week and basically say, I was portraying a character, and I was trying to get myself noticed, and it worked for a little bit, and now I notice that I'm being pushed back down the card, so, you know, people are going to learn to take Zack Ryder seriously, and then he beats somebody up, or he'll take all of his Zack Ryder garb. Remember Goldust way back when Goldust came out once on Raw back in, like, 97, with his Goldust outfit in his hand, Dustin Rhodes came out, and he threw it in a trash can and set it on fire. I feel like Zack Ryder would have to do something like that, and completely reinvent himself. And try to get himself over. Or he can just play it safe and just keep portraying the current character, which, you know, I'm sure he does well with merchandise and probably makes some nice money, but you're never going to be able to take a guy like that seriously in a main event position. It's just not going to happen. So I'm in favor of doing more serious stuff with Zack Ryder. I don't care if it's with Damian Sandow or somebody else. I am in favor of that idea. All right, let's bring back the mailbag. I know that I have not been able to get to your questions on the air for the last 2 weeks, and I'm already running low on time here, so I don't know how many I'm going to get to. But you can always email me your questions, thesolemaster@gmail.com. Let's try to get through as many of these as we can. This one comes from Richard from New York City. He's been a loyal listener since episode 38 and has two questions. I'll take two of the questions he has here. Number one, has Dolph Ziggler truly earned the opportunity to hold the world championship? He says he wants to know, if Dolph is a true main eventer, and if not, can a legitimate and clean title win put him in that spot? I'd love to see the guy perform, but I just don't think that he is on that level quite yet. Well, I'm sure part of the reason you don't think he's on that level quite yet is because of the way he's been booked. It's very hard to look at a guy like Dolph Ziggler who loses and loses and loses, or is put in matches with losers, like Swagger, who's also been booked into oblivion. And, why would I think this guy is main event material when he's not portrayed that way? I don't think you can just give him the title. I think you've given the title to other people before, and it doesn't always work. You know, the way that traditionally it would work is somebody would fight, scratch, and claw and kind of earn their way to become champion. And what they're doing nowadays, it seems like, is they kind of give the title to somebody, and they give the title to somebody as a tool by which they will then get over. Let's give them the belt. The belt will get them over. The problem is that you do so much to kind of devalue the belt that when you give the belt to somebody with the expectation that that will help get them over, it doesn't. I mean, maybe one out of every five times or something they do that. And that's not a scientific study, by the way. I just kind of pulled that out of my ass. But it's just a bad situation. I think the best way to do it, and I think Dolph works better as a heel. I don't know. He just comes across better as a heel. Maybe you turn him babyface, and maybe he gets over that way. I go back many years ago. That's exactly what happened with John Morrison. John Morrison was a heel. They, I believe, turned him babyface without any explanation at all. They didn't do a big angle explaining his turn. It's just like Christian. Christian came back. There was no great explanation for why he was suddenly a babyface. I guess he did cut that promo on SmackDown recently where he talked about, he came to some sort of realization when Edge went into the Hall of Fame or some bullshit like that. But give me a break. There was no turn for Christian. He just came back and he was a babyface. And, you know, Christian can get away with that because he's been around for a million years. He's a great performer. He works well both ways. Morrison, if I remember correctly, was a heel. They turned him face. They moved him on to SmackDown. There was no big turn. He just kind of turned. But he got over. It actually worked. He got over. So it can happen. Maybe you turn him babyface. Maybe you don't. But you gotta put him in there with some main eventers first. Get him some main event wins and then give him a shot at the title. If he just suddenly beat Sheamus for the championship, it's not going to mean shit. It's not going to mean anything. He's got to beat some people first. Prove that he deserves to be there and then give him a shot at the championship. That's how it works. That's why you don't think of him as a main eventer, because how in the world can we be expected to think of this guy as a main eventer when he's not treated like one? And Richard's other question here was about Big Show, and, you know, does WWE think that we have a horrible memory? They love to talk about how, you know, Show has pandered to the audience for 14 years, but no more. He's not going to pander to us anymore. Meanwhile, of course, Big Show has been a heel a whole bunch of times, once with Paul Heyman. He wasn't exactly pandering to the crowd throughout his entire 14-year run. So, you know what? It's one of those things where, you know, WWE is taking creative license. They're just kind of making shit up, and they've done it a million times. They have done far more to offend me. That didn't bother me. It's almost just to be expected at this point. So, but to answer your question, do they think that we have terrible memories? No, I don't think they think we have terrible memories. I think they just think we're stupid. Casey Collins writes in, since Samoa Joe is obviously not winning the Bound for Glory series, what would you think of Taz coming out of retirement for a match with Joe at Bound for Glory? I don't like that idea at all. And I don't like the idea at all just because Taz would tell you the same thing, because he talks about it a lot. He is in no physical condition to have a match. First of all, Taz is enormous. He has gained a lot of weight. He is clearly not in wrestling shape. And the biggest reason why he retired at a relatively young age is issues with his neck. Because I think he may have broken his neck many years ago in ECW, and he's had neck problems. And that was, I believe, the main reason why he retired in the first place. And I don't know that he ever had surgery to repair those issues. And you'll notice, the last Taz match I could think of, at least in WWE, they brought him back for, I think, the second one-night stand show, I believe it was, against Jerry the King Lawler. Remember they did that storyline? Which was fun, by the way. That was a really fun storyline, and the King was portraying a heel in ECW, even though he was still a babyface announcer. But they had a match that really wasn't even much of a match. So he couldn't even have a wrestling match with Jerry Lawler with all the gimmicks and stuff I'm sure they could have had to get around him actually taking bumps. All he did in that match was literally Joey Styles was down there and kind of interfering right off the bat and distracted Lawler, and Lawler backed up into Taz, who put him in the Katahajime submission, and that was it. So Taz is very limited in what he can even do. Him and Joe, of all people, because Joe can be a hard-hitting kind of guy. He can work a little stiff. Not a good idea. And I'm sure Taz would be very much unwilling to put himself in the ring in a situation where he may be injured. So, or to embarrass himself, because like I said, he is enormous. So I don't like that idea at all. They could have done this match years ago in another world, in another era. I'm sure the two of them, with all their submissions and suplexes and stuff, they probably could have had a really kick-ass match. I remember when Joe came into TNA, or not long after Joe came in, and he and Taz were put together. He was kind of Taz's protege, if I remember correctly. They had that history together, but as far as a match, Taz just can't do it. Got an email here from Shane Walker that I wanted to mention because it's a great email. I don't know if you've seen the news item. I'm sure you must have seen it on SE Scoops when it was reported that Vince McMahon is back on this kick about looking for big guys. See, at one point there was this edict down in developmental that Vince wanted them to only give a second look to people who were 6'2", 240 pounds, or bigger. And I think it kind of went to the wayside. You know, they were certainly recruiting people smaller than that. Well, Vince is back on the 6'2", 240-pound kick. And I guess the logic is he just feels like part of the reason these guys aren't getting over is because they don't look the part. A lot of these guys that are getting over or not getting over are smaller people, like a Daniel Bryan. Remember that segment on Raw a couple weeks ago when Vince basically said to him on TV, "Oh, you know, if I saw you in a supermarket, I wouldn't think of you as a WWE superstar," which, by the way, was a great fucking thing for him to say on television to one of your top stars, you idiot. But he's back on this kick because he really doesn't think these guys look like real superstars. They don't have the look. They're not big enough, according to Vince McMahon. So what Shane did in his email here is he put together a list of the current superstars on the current roster who do not make the new height or weight requirement as set forth by Vince McMahon. And maybe it's not 6'2", 240. You know, it's somewhere in that range. He's looking for big guys. And if you look at the list of people who would not meet that criteria, I'm not going to read the whole list because a majority of the roster is on this list. It includes people like CM Punk, the reigning WWE champion, one of the top stars in the company. Christian, Kofi Kingston, Chris Jericho, Daniel Bryan. David Otunga is on Shane's list here, but Otunga would make the cut just because he looks like a big jacked up dude. I know he's not actually that big, like in stature and height, excuse me, but I would take Otunga off that list because Otunga looks like a carbon copy of what Vince McMahon likes. But Ziggler, let's see, who else is on this list here? You've got John Cena, although John Cena is a freak of nature. He actually is very big. We met him in Miami. His wrists are so thick. John Cena is a much bigger dude than he appears to be on television. The Miz, Rey Mysterio, Sin Cara, Tyson Kidd, obviously, Zack Ryder. There are 37 superstars by Shane's count on the current roster who would not complete the height and or weight requirement. A majority of the WWE roster would not be hired by the company today if this policy were in place when they got hired. And you can go back even further. I'll do you one even better. Guys like Dusty Rhodes, okay, who was big, but not big the way that Vince McMahon likes it. He was a fat guy, okay? A guy like Dusty Rhodes, who didn't have the physique that Vince likes. A guy like Ric Flair, who compared to a lot of other wrestlers is a relatively small guy. Shawn Michaels, who they love to say is the greatest performer we've ever had. He would never have been given a second look back in his younger days if the policy that is in place now were in place back then. Bret Hart is another example of a guy. Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit. I'm sure I could come up with an even more extensive list. Randy Savage, okay? Now, I know he was on whatever he was on, so he looked kind of jacked up, but Randy Savage wasn't a big dude either. If Randy Savage came along right now, they wouldn't give him a second look. Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, I mean, just think of all the talent, all the legends, some of the biggest names in the history of the business, who would be cast aside or told, you know, try again in 6 months, or, you know, you get on something, start eating more, start lifting more weights. It's completely preposterous, absolutely preposterous. But that's, hey, Vince McMahon has always had a fetish with big guys. As a fan of his product, as a WWF fan from the time I was 4 years old, I've seen enough wrestling in his company over the years to be able to draw my own conclusions as to the kind of guys that Vince McMahon likes. You know, if you have two functioning, you don't have to work for the company to get people to tell you these things. If you have two functioning eyeballs with even moderately good vision, you can see this for yourself. It's just completely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And by the way, guys that are in developmental right now would probably not even be given a second look. An Antonio Cesaro probably would, because he's actually a pretty big guy. But do you think Chris Hero, as Cassius Ohno, would be given a second look? Although he's pretty tall, too. But maybe a Dean Ambrose. Okay, some of the top developmental prospects right now also probably would not be given a second look by this edict. But I'm sure you'd have guys like, you know, Vladimir Kozlov or Chris Masters when he first came along and was all big and jacked up, or the great Kali, of course, because he's a freak of nature. Forget the fact that the great Kali can barely walk, but he's a big guy, so I'm sure they'd find something for him to do. It's just completely ridiculous. Last question here from Richard Sanders, writes in, says, I recently watched the Edge documentary, You Think You Know Me. And I was sort of shocked to see two absences from the documentary. Randy Orton, during their time together as Rated RKO, and Triple H not being featured in the documentary altogether. I understand that Triple H didn't play as big of a role in Edge's career as Randy Orton did, but I was still shocked to see him off the documentary. Was or is there heat between Triple H and Edge? And was or is there heat between Edge and Randy Orton? I am not aware of any heat between Edge and Orton. And as far as Triple H is concerned, it is kind of surprising if he's not included in some form or fashion on that DVD, just to give some generic comments about, you know, Edge was a guy who, you know, had a scratch and claw his way to the top, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I was shocked just to see Triple H on the Rock DVD, because I don't care if Triple H says all these wonderful things these days about the Rock, you cannot convince me that there's not still some, maybe hate's too strong of a word, but some issues there between the two of them. Some jealousy on his part. That was the talk for so many years, and you can see it. So having to listen to Triple H on that Rock DVD just talk about what a great performer he was. He's just so entertaining with this shit-eating smile on his face. It's like, give me a break. There's just certain people that should not be... Now, you know what? Triple H should have been interviewed for the Rock DVD, but he should have just talked about the matches that he had with him, because they had some great matches together. But I think what rubbed me the wrong way was hearing him wax so eloquently about the guy. A guy who I'm sure maybe he likes him or doesn't like him or is jealous of his success or whatever the case may be. But as far as Triple H and Edge is concerned, the only thing I ever heard, I am not aware of any heat between them. The only thing I ever heard was when Edge got moved over to SmackDown. When Edge, I believe it might have been when Edge beat The Undertaker on his second Money in the Bank cash-in. And he won the World Heavyweight Championship, and I think that put him on SmackDown at that point, once he won the SmackDown title, because I think he had been on Raw up until that point. And I remember hearing that, Edge is going to be really happy now, that he's away from Triple H, and he's on a different brand, that he can make that brand his own. Because so long as, especially back then, so long as you were on the same brand with Triple H, you were not going to be the top guy. And Edge was I don't know that Edge lobbied for it, but Edge was very happy to find out that he was not going to be on the same brand with Triple H. Now, that doesn't mean there was heat between them. I always took that just to mean what we all knew, just because we could watch TV and see it, that Triple H was the alpha male. He was the number one guy, and it would be very difficult for another younger guy or another main event performer to kind of be on the same show and truly be the number one guy. And by Edge being allowed to be on a different brand altogether, he really carried SmackDown on his back and made that show his and got himself even more over in the process away from Triple H. And the other part of that is you didn't have Triple H around on that brand to beat Edge. Because what would be gained by having Triple H beat Edge at that point? So Edge was very happy, supposedly, being away from Triple H at that time. Aside from that, I am not aware of any sort of heat or issues between the two of them. I've never heard anything. So that answers your question. So that's going to do it. Episode 224, a still somewhat small mailbag. I promise I will get to more questions. Just don't have enough time these days. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything that I get. And I appreciate your feedback. When you do write in, please include your name, where you're from, and also if you can remember from about which episode you've been listening to the sound off from, so I know how far back you go. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle on there. Always posting on there more often probably than anywhere else. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You can search for me if you want to on Facebook. It'll be the wonderful portrait of me that Steve Willerette did, the illustration. That's my new profile picture. So if you find that, you know that that's the official page. You can send me a friend request. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. It is free. It does not cost you anything. You can subscribe. And anytime a new episode is downloaded, it will automatically be download it to your computer or, I guess, your mobile device. I guess maybe you could set it up that way. It'll automatically be downloaded for you. So be sure to check that out as well. I appreciate all the support. We have a lot of new listeners, so hopefully you'll keep listening and you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next weekend with episode 225 of The Solomonster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. Until then, be well, stay safe, have a great week, and we'll see you right back here next time.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.